Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on the nature of consciousness and life continuum as revealed through near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences. Some of the topics include what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature a stellar roster of special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. For more information about our organization, Toward the Light, on this radio program, please visit our website, towardthelight.org, and towardthelight.info. This week I'm very pleased to have Jerry Winstrom, who is the author of the beautiful book, The Inspired Heart. It is really an amazing journey that Jerry has been on, and we are going to talk about this, how he just gave over to radical trust in the divine and being true to soul, a tremendous journey. So let us welcome to Toward the Light, Jerry Winstrom. Hello, Jerry, and welcome.
Hello, Juliet. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. And I'm really enjoying reading the introduction to your book, which actually I put on your profile page on towardthelight.org. It is quite a remarkable journey. And being a fellow artist, even though I've been a little bit more dormant in the sense of putting paintbrush to canvas and all of that stuff, I can certainly relate to what you've been through, both as an artist and just giving over to radical trust. Tell us about this, where you you destroyed your artwork and just set out on a journey to discover soul, to discover light source. Tell us about this, and I think you were quite a young man when this occurred, correct?
Yes, I was 29 at the time. It's what astrologers call a period of Saturn return, which was a time of sort of radical transformation for many of us. And I was very driven as an artist, and the studio being something of a laboratory where you can kind of experiment and dabble in creation in a certain sense, in the safety of that environment. I felt I took art as far as it could go. I mean, I had produced an enormous body of work. And it was at that point, you know, I think it's the point where we often say, what a good boy or girl am I, that reality shifts. And I sensed that something was changing and art no longer served me in the way that it had. And on the strength of that and feeling that I began fasting. Usually when I would fast when I sensed changes were underway. I fasted once a week for about 12 years anyway, just to help inspiration and cleanse. So it was a part of my life. And so after fasting for a month, it became very clear that I could keep doing what I was doing. And art in New York, and certainly Soho, was really flying high in the 70s. And it was at the height of that kind of, you know, screaming golden calf of art that I let it all go. But after fasting, it became clear that I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice. And the world certainly was on board with that choice. Or I could give myself to what I intuited was everything I was looking for. There was a kind of strange abstract excitement about letting it all go. And it promised nothing. It was a huge risk. I mean, it was going against the grain in every sense. But I intuited something really beautiful there that I knew I had to give myself to. And on the strength of that clarity, I destroyed my work, all of my work. I gave everything I owned away. And I decided to trust life just as it came, moment to moment after that. And I proceeded to live that way for 15 years until my return, in a certain sense, to the world.
Well, what a beautiful point you are making there, to honoring your intuitive impulses, that the messages that came to you intuitively. And that is such a beautiful and important example of what people really need to do. And the other really valid point that you made was the fact that holding on to things as they were is indeed fear-based. This will provide me, quote, security and what have you to continue doing work in this way. That is a really brilliant point that people do need to listen to, because so many times, you made a powerful choice, being what I would call true to soul, honoring your intuition to do this. And a number of people, myself included, weren't granted the luxury of choice, but were just flung into something so similar to this. And it really pushes us to the limit. And I really commend you for doing this. And I wanted to really bring up that point that people need to know how important it is to listen to our intuition, because that is soul speaking to us. So do go ahead and share with us more detail about this. Again, I was reading the introduction, and it's just very, very beautiful. You make some tremendous points here. So carry on with some of the things that you went through in this radical journey, as it were.
Yeah. Well, when we take risks, or when we're up against a moment like that, that feels so all or nothing. It may be crazy. We don't know sometimes. And I think, what the end result ultimately is what inspires us to keep on with the journey that we've stepped into. And it's really like jumping off of a ship. You're in a whole new environment, which is a new liquid reality, and you're not quite sure how to navigate this new environment. And I think it's about learning as you go. And there's no way to learn until you've made that leap. So the initial leap was the beginning of that, but then it was the lessons learned, to completely trust reality just as it was. I never asked anyone for anything. I just took what came and fasted a lot, and so that continued on. And I think what you've described as getting flung into it, I think many people, and certainly many of the people we're working with these days, are people going through that. I think it really is in the spirit of the time that we're going through that kind of metaphoric death. I think death is really all around us. And if we can walk straight into it, if we can deal with the metaphor, then the reality of death becomes an ally rather than something to be feared. What we find there is life and not death at all.
Absolutely.
And the best of all seats in the house, you might say, is to be a willing participant in that process. Like whatever's going on, you're going through a painful divorce, or you're losing all your money, or you have no money, that's the God of this moment here and now. And I think to be able to participate in that moment as if it were holy ground rather than some great catastrophe, I think is the beginning of that befriending process, where in the end, the one big boogeyman in our life, which is death, becomes our friend, and it becomes the place of renewal rather than the destructive thing that we project onto it.
That's an interesting comment there, too, because I would actually regard the boogeyman as fear or the ego, as we truly come to understand what death is. It's something that doesn't really exist. It's about transformation and transcendence and transmuting, moving to a higher frequency and moving closer to our divine heritage, which is light. And so, the whole idea of my work is to really help remove the stigma around death. And in fact, that's a word that I most often avoid using, because I believe that it is an inaccurate term. That really what we do is transition. We move through a doorway. And this really sounds like what happened to you as well. And another sort of metaphor I've been seeing, and I've certainly been experiencing it myself, going through what has often been referred to as a shaman's death. And I certainly went through that this winter, and actually almost experienced a literal transitioning, leaving my body in the spring. So, again, it just like you said, it is all around us. We're all being challenged, I think, with this awakening to become more aware and more in tune to who we really are and what source is. Now, wouldn't you say that with this experience that you had, it really forced you to be in the present?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was nowhere else to be when you've given it all up. I mean, you're so dependent on what the moment calls for. You know, responding to the moment correctly. And also, when we don't have any buffer, there is nothing else. I mean, it reduces reality to that kind of one-on-one relationship with the mystery just as it unfolds, and it never unfolds in the way that our reason and logic might think. I would also like to say that death, in fact, is a transformational process if we are willing participants. But, you know, I think a lot of people also experience the pain and the ugly side of death by avoiding it. So, you know, it seems important to acknowledge that it's not all love and light in that process. I mean, it depends on how much courage we can meet it with. Because I think, you know, many of us have also experienced some kind of loss, whether it's a physical loss or even just a kind of a blow to the psyche where we just feel we were just leveled because our illusions come undone. And I think, you know, when we hold on to our illusions, we really do experience death like death. It's in a perfectly appropriate word in that sense. So how do you become a willing participant and make it beautiful? Because that's there too. That's what wants to happen. I think that's what our birthright is, to experience in the way you describe. But it's also important to know that it's dangerous. You know, life is dangerous. We can feel pain for wrong action, for living in denial, or for, you know, trying to avoid those difficult places. So both of those are in place. When we know that, we can approach life more like a warrior with all the dangers intact and find that beauty in there.
So when you went to this, am I correct in assuming that you were also destitute or homeless?
Well, there was a point, and I write about these moments. My book is a series of those sort of quantum leaps where everything I was about, everything I thought I was doing, everything I thought I was, failed, and I trusted the failure itself, and something came through. And those were the transformational moments that, you know, sort of brought about that renewal.
It kind of reminds me of when I've done, I do music and also art, and I would be working on a project, and then I would create what at first appeared like a mistake or an accident or what have you, and then it would end up turning into something quite brilliant and beautiful, and then there was a discovery that happened in the process of doing that. And it seems to me that when we allow ourselves to flow, you know, life is very much the same way. We think that we're experiencing something unfortunate or, oh no, this isn't what I plan to do with this. And then it ends up being something much better than what we had originally vied for.
Yes, it gets back to what you said earlier about being present with it, even that thing that looks like error. You know, and you think that another response to error is to, you know, is to come down hard on ourselves and avoid and sort of, you know, jump out of that moment of seemingly failure. My favorite quote is one by Yogananda that says, all of our lives are a holy purpose, whether we call it that or not. But his quote is, to set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. So in other words, sort of a kind of something that looks like death and failure is written in to that place of our human control, our will, intelligence, and good intention. And being there at that point is probably the most important time to be present, not with our successes, that's easy, but with that moment that feels like failure, and trust even the God of that moment. I mean, that's the Christ story. That's, you know, it's also Lao Tzu says, most of us blow it at the end. Most of us at that place, we run for cover when there is enlightenment, there's renewal, you know, there's the place of the proverbial resurrection for all of us.
Well, and also there's been such a misconception of what constitutes true success, as it were, as well as other things. So what may be considered a failure by the egoic or societal standards and so forth is really quite the contrary.
So
again, you know, this process of really venturing out to endeavor to honor the intuition and being true to soul and flowing into light source, I think is a very, very powerful experience. And once you've been through this, you are indeed changed forever. I wanted to ask you some of the experiences. You said that the soul journey, or journey as it were, lasted for 15 years. What are some of the things that happened? If you'd like to share some of this with our listeners during that 15-year period, and then of course I want to ask you, when did it come to a conclusion for you that enabled you to just move into the next step, as it were?
Yeah, well, you know, there, like I said, the journey has been these quantum leaps, and so that's this. You know, it's not like it ends. I think what ends is a kind of divine retirement, where you, when you have befriended the death experience, what you get is, you know, I think even the Christian notion of eternal life, until you die and are reborn, you won't experience eternal life. I mean, to me, and this doesn't matter what your religious persuasion, eternity is the ability to find renewal in emptiness. And when we come up against that emptiness in the cyclical nature of things, to be able to find that emptiness is the gift. And the ability to do that comes with having faced our death one good time. You know, so, you know, there are many stories about how those moments came about. And again, you know, I that's what my book is about. If there's something in particular, I could probably come up with a story. But, you know, it was about every aspect of life, including we all come through with a family shadow, having the family shadow undone that was running so unconsciously in me, like it is in most of us. I mean, we don't even know how much a product of our own family shadow we are. We're so busy bouncing off of it and feeling the pain of it that we, to have it undone by way of being simply present with it in a different kind of way, there's real freedom in everything we face. So we pursue more when our fears that come up rather than necessarily the easy places in our sort of, you know, the things that we have gotten very good at. Because in our fears is our liberation, if we can keep walking into those and walking into those. And that's what the journey has been for me. And the gift of it is not some kind of something I can put in my pocket and take to the bank. It's more like the gift of death itself, which is a promise. In other words, I still, at some level, fail. I still don't know what I'm doing. But to trust that place where all of that sense of, you know, disempowerment sort of comes through for us, I think is where the gift comes through, like once again, a quantum leap. But in returning to the world, I mean, there really was a moment, you know, to try and answer your question a little better. You know, it was like most of us, kicking and screaming, letting go of the world, letting go of all the things I let go of slowly. And I would let go more and more and more. There was a whole year where I hardly spoke because I just felt like I was afraid of silence, you know, in a public situation. Or there were times when I would speak out of nervousness. Or so then even speech had to go. And I thought, you know, in every way it was really difficult because everything felt like it was going to be forever. And the moment, and after several years, the moment I really gave myself, felt like I can do this emptiness now. I was at a place where I was ready to pat myself on the back. I can do emptiness. And the moment I sort of did that is the moment the gods upped the ante and in a sense said, okay, now it's time to go back into the world, which was a whole new challenge, opening up to relationship, opening up just to sexual energies and sort of exploring sexuality in a kind of tantric way without being sexual. All of those things were terrifying for me coming back to the world, you know, eventually I was asked to write my book, and the film was, you know, there's a film In the Hands of Alchemy that Parabola magazine originally put out, and now it's Sentient Publication. And then public speaking and doing this stuff we're doing now, and it continues. I mean, the return to the world is all still part of that sort of expansion. So, you know, I don't know that there's any place where, except that to say, what we come to depend on is a moment of grace and not a moment of will, intelligence, and good intentions to save us. That's the final gift. It's as simple as that.
Now, when you were going through this journey, were you in New York? Did you remain in New York, or did you actually travel somewhere else?
Well, it was mostly on the East Coast, New York. And when I came to the Northwest, I now live on Whidbey Island off of near Seattle, Washington.
In the Puget Sound, correct?
Yes. When I came here, it really defined the return to the world, you know. And again, I mean, it's such a huge transition and story, but I often describe it like the tide. You know, the tide, the ocean tide goes out as far as it's going to go. And there's a moment of stillness where you don't know whether you're coming or going. And you're so much in the momentum of going out. In a sense, I was in the momentum of letting go. And then there was this stillness, and I was a confusing kind of time, and that's when I came to the Northwest, and that's when reality shifted. Coming here was very much a return to the world. People in this, there was a wonderful community here, was called Chinook, which is now the Whidbey Institute. You know, people really got my story. I was called on to speak publicly. I began working with people. So this was really the return coming here. So, you know, there was a pretty well-defined shift there.
I would gather that, and it seems like a very, very powerful one. And when I heard you talking about the emptiness and the void, there was something in me that was saying that even in those moments, there still isn't complete emptiness, because at least with my own experiences in that, and so much of what you've been through, I also have been through. It's really quite striking to hear you talk about this, where we were completely emptied, as it were, and then there was only room for us to be more truly filled with our true essence, which is the soul self, rather than everything being dictated by ego, which is dominated by fear. And so even in, at least for me in these moments, and I would fast literally for weeks at a time. And the truth is, I didn't want to start eating again because I really loved what fasting did for me. But in order to function in the world, I did need to be grounded. So then I had to start feeding the body again. And it was a very interesting process for me shortly after coming to America, when I, you know, again, went through a very similar process that you did on being emptied out, and yet even in that so-called void, I still found something was there. I could feel that bit of love reminding me, you really are not alone. And I think that's an important message for people to garner from all of this too, is that when we go through these experiences, there's a profound discovery that we indeed are not alone. Wouldn't you say that this happened to you as well?
Oh, of course. I mean, I know with this strange and lonely journey that it sounds like you as well have gone through, I think what you find out is that there is no way you can pull off such a vacuous reality without helping hands. There's just no way. There's no way you could continue. I mean, we would drop in our tracks halfway if there were not that gift, the gifts that came through. And, you know, and sometimes the gift was simply an inspiration that you're exactly in the best seat in the house, right where you need to be, right here and now, with everything difficult. And sometimes it would be just simply the necessary physical components of existence on the planet. I mean, however it came through, one learns very quickly that there are helping hands there working this thing. And I don't think we're capable of trusting it if we didn't see that. And I think a big part of it, too, is honoring that and appreciating that even in the emptiness, even though we don't have seemingly what the rest of the world has with its abundance at a particular moment. To appreciate the gifts that come through, I think, is what keeps them coming, and it keeps the sparkle in life for all of us.
And indeed, what I'm seeing with you is that you're tremendously wealthy, especially as a result of all of these experiences that you've been through, and I'm certain that it's really inspired you in your art. So let's talk about your art a little bit, and I also would like to ask you about the film In the Hands of Alchemy.
Yes, well, we might at this point, for anyone listening, if they would like to see the art, our website is handsofalchemy.com. It's ALCHEMY.com, handsofalchemy.com. So the art, it's kind of interesting at this point. I now have a new huge body of work. I have this 2,000 square foot studio that's quite full of these box beings. And what I see in retrospect, you know, they're all very coffin-like. They're between 6 and 8 or 9 feet tall. They all have beings inside, and they're very coffin-like. And when you look at them, you know, like I had a friend who owns a bookstore in St. Louis visit, and one day he walks into my studio very nervously, and he's kind of a nervous little guy anyway, and he looks around and he says, you know, if someone wasn't in a very good space, they would be kind of afraid of this place. And it was kind of comical, but I know at some level on the surface that might be the first reaction, just like when we're faced with our fears. Yet, if you can face these art pieces, they're whimsical, they dispense gifts, you know, they do unexpected things. Many of them have electrical components that make sounds, and you know, there are many secret compartments with secret beings inside that emerge, and things are changing and moving. So what I see in retrospect is that, like my journey, you know, and like the journey you described for yourself, what you find is that when you can fully inhabit the death, when you can face it, there are gifts there, and it just keeps giving. And it's, you know, and I think I like what the what Starhawk says. She has a quote: "Where there's fear, there's power." And I think it's the nature of duality, the nature of opposites, that when we experience fear, it makes us come more alive, and it keeps life on a more crispy, lively edge. And so it's inevitable. Anything that we are become so bored with is already dead. And I think any aspect of our life that's going to give us the kind of joy we hope for will always have an element of risk and fear right next to it. It's the nature of duality. But you become quite good at facing that challenge, however it comes. But so my art are these death-like boxes that dispense gifts that are joyful. That's what my art is now.
What are some? I take it it's mixed media that you use. What are some of the media that you use to create your art pieces?
Well, I use a lot of cedar. I'm carving life-size figures. You know, I use everything imaginable. A lot of non-ferrous metals, a lot of machinery, electrical components. And again, they're explained on the website. Mm-hmm. Like a recent piece I did was formerly a baby grand piano that was given to me. And I turned it in. I have a being now inside. I put it on end. I cut parts of it away. I gutted it. And so it's now, again, one of a box-like, and it has a figure inside, a life-size carved figure. And so the piano pedals I put at the bottom, and you push one pedal with your foot, and the head turns around, and the back of the head opens up like a little door, a double door, and there's a carved skull inside, sort of a life and death kind of thing. And the other pedal, the hands are in praying position. When you step on that pedal, they open up, and there's a poem. And the poem will say, the final line of the poem is, if you can't dance, buzz God. And so one of the keys on the piano, if you push it, it's a brass key, and it says, Buzz God. If you push it, this large buzzer goes off and sort of startles you and makes you laugh. I mean, that's, you know, I use everything. I have something I call the confessional. I was brought to Italy two summers ago, and I was really struck by these ancient confessionals that were hundreds of years old, so well-worn that where people knelt down, they were half-moon shapes from the knees rubbing on the wood and fingernail marks in the prayer stand. And so they embodied so much forgiveness and angst and guilt and all of the things that we go through the human experience, that I was just so struck by these things, I decided to make something. So I have this huge hollowed out log with a door cut into it, which is a figure that opens, and inside is a saint when you first open it. And there's a mask, a lower mask that you open up, and there's a big electrical switch when you flip it, and it's sort of in the pubic area, the switch. So when you flip the switch, the angel, the saint, becomes a devil. His halo disappears. His hands reach out and hand you an apple. His little horns come out of his head. A forked tongue comes out and his tail wags. So then he goes from that to goes back to being a saint. So again, it's sort of the whimsical play with duality and the sort of, you know, the opposites that we inhabit as human beings.
Now, what do the boxes represent? The boxes that encase your pieces.
The boxes themselves?
Yes. I sense that there might be some kind of meaning around that, or are they just meant to be frames, as it were?
Well, like I say, they're very coffin-like. I mean, the first one that happened, I was reading Jung's book, Man and His Symbols. And there was this incredible Egyptian sarcophagus in the book, painted inside, and I was so taken by it, I decided to make something like it. That's where it all started. But I think they're very coffin-like. Again, that sort of scary territory that offers a gift. I mean, that's what I see in retrospect. I didn't plan that. The more practical side of a box is I can just fill it with all these electrical components and wiring, secret compartments, you know, whereas a flat canvas, what you see is what you get right on the surface. So, you know, there are several. I love the mystery of a box and little compartments and surprises and all of that, you know, all that which that you can do in a box.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense too. And also, looking at the cover of your book, Inspired Heart, would you like to tell us about that piece of work that's on the cover of your book?
Yeah, well, that's actually the first piece that I mentioned, and that piece has actually an interesting story. I decided to make this sarcophagus-like object, and it was 6 feet tall and was kind of narrow, so when I decided to put a figure inside, I thought I would make a mold. You know, my later things all have carved cedar figures, but the first one has a plaster figure. I decided to make a mold of someone, and I thought, I need a very thin person to fit in this box. And one day, coming home on the ferry, I ran into a friend, and she asked what I was doing. And I told her about this art piece, and I said, now I need a really thin woman to make a mold of her body to put inside. And so she said, oh, I know just the person, and she loves art. I'm sure she would be willing to do this. So we arranged it. The woman came over, and we, you know, it's a pretty, pretty wild process creating a mold on somebody's body. So I had a couple people helping me, one of which was my wife's mother, who is here. She's an artist. So we covered the woman's body with Vaseline, and then we completely covered her in plaster. But the interesting part of this story is, you know, that art piece that's on the cover of my book is about birth and death. I call it birth and death. And it has a pregnant glass belly, and there's a strobe light behind it, which is in the belly of the inner figure. And so when the strobe light goes, it shines through the pregnant belly on the outside of the figure. So birth and death is, it's called. But the interesting thing about doing this piece with this woman who I didn't know is that in the middle of this, she got claustrophobic because she was covered in plaster. All that was open were her nostrils so she could breathe. And in the middle of it, I knew she was really starting to panic. And so finally I said, okay, if you have to jump up and smash it, go ahead. You can do that if you want to. And so she knew she could, and so she hung in there and we finished it. But part of when this was going on, my friend who was helping is a body worker, the woman who actually brought this person to have the mold made. And so she sensed something going on with her too, and she just did her body work that she usually does with people who are very frightened. And so she did this. And when it was all done, here's what I didn't know. You know, like I say, it's about a pregnant figure and an inner figure, so birth and death. The woman was pregnant, and she was going through a divorce, and she didn't want to be pregnant. When she got home that day, she miscarried, and at the same time, the glass on the belly of the piece, I had used a large slab of wet cedar, and so when it dried, the glass cracked, which felt very much like a kind of miscarriage, you might say. And
that's
so there was some strange mystery around the creation of this thing. And I feel like I go into these things, I never know what's really going on. I don't stick to any plan. I sort of try to follow the allurements. And I'm always surprised by what happens. And I think when things like this happen, however strange, I mean, none of it planned, I feel all is well on the creative front. I mean, it's the place that I feel most alive as an artist when that kind of thing, larger than me and my intent, happens.
That's like what I was mentioning before, the happy accident, as I call it.
Yes.
I also used to make candles, and I used to paint, doing oil paintings and drawing and even some sculpting. And so something would just sort of seem to have a mind of its own and go in its own direction. And then I would become the observer, interestingly, of the process, even though it was my hands being used to create the piece. So this is very interesting, and I find it quite auspicious, this sort of synchronicity, as it were, between this subject. And again, you'd put petroleum jelly on her and then plaster over it? Is that what you use?
Yeah, so you have what you end up with is a hollow, like a mold of a person's whole body. You know, the back was open, and so then with the mold, which is now concave, I filled that with plaster, so the actual finished figure is a solid figure. Then you peel the mold off, and you have a three-dimensional solid figure, which is what that image on the cover of my book. And also, the art piece is inside with the door open and closed. You see the glass belly. It's also on our website, once again, handsofalchemy.com, if people want to see it, look at sculptures. And I actually tell this story on our blog on the writings, so it's a story I just wrote, so it's pretty fresh in my mind.
Oh, it's a wonderful sight and very info-rich. and then also your pages on towardthelight.org/Jerry Winstrom, WENNSTROM.html. And this is really, really lovely. I'm quite intrigued by what you're sharing here. Now, if you will, tell us a bit about, I guess this was a presentation that you gave, Radical Departure.
Yes, that was, I guess it was a couple of months ago. And now we're having a follow-up, which is more, Marilyn is doing more of this. I'll come in as a guest presenter. It was at the Whidbey Institute, which is this wonderful place at the Thomas Berry Hall. And so the Radical Departures, what we did is we showed three films, one by David Bloom called Appointment with a Wise Old Dog. It's this incredible film that David did at the end of his life. David was a world-renowned composer, musician, and so Yo-Yo Ma did the intro to this film. And this film is about David's conscious walk into death, literal death. You know, he was dying. He was diagnosed with cancer, and he followed. He started doing this art, which led him, you know, in the most beautiful way, into death itself. And in it, at the end of his film, he calls it a miracle. He calls the process of his very literal death a miracle. And it's this powerful, wonderful film. And I know Marion Woodman has really put the film on the map by showing it around the world in her work. You know, she's a pretty well-known Jungian. And so that was one film. The other film, the second film, was In the Hands of Alchemy, the film about my metaphoric death, which, you know, also, if anyone is interested, you can look on YouTube, and there's a link on our website to the videos, and you can actually watch all these films. There's a bunch on there that other people have put on, and friends, but you can watch In the Hands of Alchemy. And so that's about, you know, it's a combination of two films, one made in 79, because there was a film being made about my art at that time. And that's before the film was done is when I destroyed all my work and let it all go. And so that film, they included at that time me talking about it as a young man. I was 29 at the time. And so that's the second film. And then the third one, so that's the metaphoric death. So we had metaphoric death, literal death. And then we showed the third film, called A Family Undertaking, which is about home and family funerals, about the incredible healing that comes with people who take on the care of their own beloved, you know, those who die in their lives, who they very much love and have been in their lives. So it's about home and family funerals and the process of the healing process for people who do it, from everything from washing the body, you know, sometimes building coffins or painting them or having children put flowers on or in the coffins. And people actually, the whole family participating in the death process the way it has been for hundreds of years until we've sort of mechanized it. And so we dealt with the three levels of death. And we had Sarah Bloom, David Bloom's widow, spoke, and Marilyn worked with A Family Undertaking, and I spoke and worked with the metaphoric death from my film. So it was a pretty powerful night, pretty successful. We had a great audience, so much so that the Whidbey Institute asked us to do a follow-up, which Marilyn is heading up. I mean, she can talk about that more. I know you want to do a interview with her, and she's doing home and family funerals, so she can talk more about that part of it.
That would be very wonderful, because there's so much that I've been working on, and of course with a number of other people too, about conscious living and dying and a quality of transitioning, as it were. And I have to say, from my own death experiences, when I was dying of terminal cancer and then lost all my vital signs on my birthday, that was a huge and powerful near-death experience in the mid-70s. And I actually embraced the dying process with open arms, because it was not frightening to me. In fact, the more I became removed from this dimension and moved on to other dimensions, I experienced a profound sense of peace. And interestingly, as an artist, I saw the colors become more vibrant and brilliant and light, very, very luminous. And again, so much of this is to really help people understand that it is about just a shift, a change, movement into something different. Not really an end so much, just a change, like moving house. We move away from one realm or place and move into another one. But we never cease to be, we never lose consciousness, we never lose selfhood. And so I really appreciate all of the work that people like you and Marilyn are doing, and these other people that you have mentioned, who are helping to really bring light to all of this, to have it be a very creative and loving process, and to remove this stigma surrounded by all of this, to just face it squarely and realize, well, goodness me, it's nothing but just a shift. a change, and it can indeed be something very, very beautiful and uplifting. And some of the work that I've seen with hospice workers, they just have very special experiences as they were working with the dying people. Their visions, the communications that they have, and even sharing spontaneous deathbed visions. Even some of the workers would share these experiences in sync with those who are in the dying process. So that is very special. Now, did you also took this film, am I correct, you took it to the Hawaiian Islands. You were on Kauai with this.
Yes, we did. We were just back a few days, actually. We did an event at the Kauai Museum, a film event. You know, we toured with Parabola magazine for a couple of years, and we've been, you know, the last probably 5 or 7 years touring the country with the film. But we were first time in Kauai at the Kauai Art Museum, Kauai Museum. And it was what we do, show the film. Marilyn opens with music, and we show the film, and I speak and work with the audience, and then Marilyn closes with the song. And it was just a really, I mean, we were surprised at the interest and the success of it. I mean, Marilyn says it was one of the best events we've ever had. It was standing room only. It was pretty nice. But we've done it. We've done other museums, Birmingham Art Museum, Seattle Art Museum, but, you know, a lot of different venues over the years. And the film is still alive and well. It's now, like I said, on YouTube, which is a link from our site. So it's getting out in some way. And I think, you know, I don't claim that it's our work as much as it is the zeitgeist. I think it is so up right now. There's so much talk about death and renewal and the whole process at all levels. I just think it's what is. Often I feel the most sensitive among us, you know, the artists, the poets, anybody saying yes to the subtleties of life are the first to go through it. And so I know many of the people we're working with are people in one way or another, their lives are falling apart. You know, everything is, whether it's not necessarily a literal death like you had to experience, but it really is indistinguishable. I mean, when all is lost, it's you don't discriminate between what's literal and what's real. I mean, I think very often that's why people will do the extreme of committing suicide, because they'd rather die physically than have their egos die. So I think many people at all levels are experiencing it. And however it happens, like you say, if you get kind of bumped over into it, or you're a willing participant, I think it's so much in the spirit of the time, and it's the important work to be doing, to embrace that and find the renewal. And I think if anything is going to save our world, and in hearing your story, Juliet, I think, I mean, I can't help but feel there's a part, I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but I feel like I think your work in the world and your being here now has a direct relationship to your willingness to face your death. You're here because you could die. And, you know, I think often when we avoid it, we suffer a kind of useless suffering, a useless, you know, thing that feels and looks like death. But it's up for all of us now. I think it's the thing that'll save our world, to co-create instead of just willfully do what we want in the world.
I totally agree with that. I really resonate with that, too. And another point that I wanted to make is that I think as more and more people can come to truly understand what death is and what it isn't, that there won't be so much suicide, because the fact is we do not escape anything when we commit suicide. We still remain conscious. We still have to face whatever it is we're dealing with, even though the body has been eliminated. And this is a very important point that needs to be stressed, is that indeed we escape nothing by committing suicide. There isn't just a blackness and a void. We do continue on. And that's a huge part of why so many of us have been sent back, and a number of us, countless times, I've had a number of death experiences, which is actually more accurate than near death, because the physical body literally does die. So we come back bearing a message. Guess what? We live forever. And so we need, and yet the the metaphorical death, you know, there's so much about letting go of our, or the ego's will to be in control, because the truth is we really are not in control. It is about flowing. It is about co-creating with Source, just as you were saying, and flowing with all of the energies that are with us at any given moment, and also realizing once again that we are not alone. So this I hope is going to help people, because it is frightening what's going on in the world right now, and yet at the same time, as it's getting darker, so too it is getting lighter, much lighter simultaneously. And it is about where we choose to put our focus. Are we going to place our focus in love, or are we going to just let it be carried down into the pits of fear?
I would sure agree with that. I mean, it's what I was saying earlier about the art. I think it is true. You know, even if you look at like a painting, if you look at the lightest part of a painting, you'll see it's right next to the darkest dark. I think there is an underpinning which is emerging, which is so completely powerful and beautiful. And, you know, the only way through it is to dig down in the surface of all the ugliness and the fear and all the things that are projected on the surface of our media and in the surface of ourselves, our egos. I think there's no way to get to that source and that essence that is emerging except to participate in it, to get to it in whatever it takes, and to become a willing participant in bringing it forth in the world.
And I think a wonderful point with that, too, is that what appears to be the greatest nightmare is also the greatest gift, or gifts in our lives. And it's so interesting. I take evening walks by the water. I live right next to the water, and so I love the water and watching the sunsets. And there's an interesting metaphor right there, because I behold these beautiful, deeply rich, dark-colored clouds, and then this glowing crimson light breaking through the clouds, and I'm just so awestruck by the magnificent beauty of that. But there again is your perfect example, the light and the dark being right next to each other, very visible and just awe-inspiring. So that's a wonderful point and a wonderful metaphor as well. I did want to ask you quickly, what inspired you to get into these film projects with the Radical Departure? And another really quick point I want to make, too, is that Carl Jung is a near-death experience. What brought up about this interest in doing these magnificent films In the Hands of Alchemy and Radical Departure, etc.?
Well, you see, the films were made about me. I didn't make them. I'm not a filmmaker. I mean, it all started with the first film, 1979, which was in process before I destroyed my work. And then that filmmaker, Mark Sedan, looked me up some 25, 30 years later and wanted to make the new one. And then he incorporated the two, along with Phil Lucas, who's a Native American film director who did the Native American series for PBS. He's done 65 films. And I was the first white person he had ever made a film about. So the films have been, I'm not a filmmaker, but because we have the film, we've toured with it, Parabola picked it up, and we've done a lot of work with them, that it's just a part of what we do now. And then when I saw David Bloom's film, Appointment with a Wise Old Dog, I was so moved by it. It's such a brilliant, incredible film. And David's so courageous and beautiful, the way he walks into his literal death and finally does die at the end, but so beautifully. It was so necessary a film. Marilyn and I just got excited by the possibility, Marilyn's worked with a woman, Jerry Grace Lyons, on Home and Family Funerals, and a PBS film was made about her as well, called The Family Undertaking. So it made sense. Let's put them all together and work at all levels with death. And you know, and the success of the program, I just think it speaks to the spirit of the time in many ways.
Oh, I was just going to say, too, how timely indeed that is. And I think it's a really wonderful project, and how inspiring to go through this. So what year was it, Gary, that you actually destroyed all of your work and started on that journey? I know you said you were, 29 or something. What year was that?
It was
1979.
Yeah.
Okay. And then that ultimately took you to Woodby Island in Washington. I believe I've been there. I know I've been on some of the islands there at the...
Well, Whidbey Island came 15 or more years later. I moved here in 88. I came for the first time.
Oh, okay.
So it's been a long journey getting here, but I feel, I feel at the sort of celebratory end of the journey where, you know, it's still important to be vigilant and tend what needs tending, but I do feel... It's like learning to dance, you know, you kind of, when you're told to put your feet here, here, and here, it makes no sense and even feels and looks ridiculous. But eventually, when you learn the dance and the music comes on, it becomes very natural. And I feel the gift of death and the gift of renewal and the dance that it has become is very much the celebratory end of things. And the way it's going out into the world as a very kind of unique, in a way, I think any of us, whatever we can give ourselves to, our lives are all so different that some unique aspect will find expression in the world if we have the courage to live that individuality, you know, which is terrifying for most of us. We want our lives to look like something known, when if we can just be with our own unknowing, what emerges is a very unique expression. And I feel the gift of that expression is emerging, and it has very little to do with what I thought I was about in life and everything to do with what life really has been about.
Well, you've set such a wonderful, wonderful example, and I feel such a kindred spirit in you because of this, too. It's really brilliant and inspiring, and again, I want to let our listeners know the title of your book is The Inspired Heart. And the website is handsofalchemy.com. Is that correct, or is it the hands? It's just Hands of Alchemy.
Yes, Hands of Alchemy. Or jerrywenstrom.com, but my name's harder to spell.
Okay. Yes, I'm always teaching people how to spell alchemy, too, because, of course, I've got alchemymusic.org, so alchemy has been a very huge part of my vocabulary for many, many years. Do you have any special events coming up that you'd like to share with our listeners before we close, Jerry?
Well, we have the follow-up to Radical Departures, which is in November 2nd at the Whidbey Institute. What else? I have an event at Pacifica Graduate Institute in the fall, and Inside Edge both in California, in the Ojai, Santa Barbara area. On our website, we have the schedule. It's pretty, we update it pretty regularly. So things come when they come, and we do what we can do.
Well, Jerry, it's been so wonderful having you on Toward the Light. And I want to thank you so much. And we'll have to get Marilyn on the show, too. And indeed, we will, because it will be lovely to talk with her and find out all of the magnificent things that she's done and experienced as well. You've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. Our guest this hour has been Jerry Winstrom, the author of The Inspired Heart, a beautiful, beautiful book and a wonderful journey that he's been on. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. Next week, our special guest is going to be Chris Evard, and I hope you will join us then for another transmission of Toward the Light. Blessings and light to all of you. We will speak to you next.